Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Home in Progress, sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Now, on today's episode, we're going to dig into another architectural style in our ongoing series. And this one's got a fascinating story behind it. We'll be exploring Victorian architecture. You know, those ornate homes with turrets, spindles, gingerbread trim, bay windows, bold colors. You know the ones. They're impossible. Absolutely impossible to miss. But here's what most people don't know. Victorian architecture isn't actually one style. It's a whole collection of styles from Gothic Revival to Queen Anne, all happening during Queen Victoria's reign from 1837 to 1901. So it's actually Victorian era architecture that we're talking about when we talk about Victorian architecture. All right, now, all of that decoration that we think of when we think about Victorian homes, you know, all that elaborate ornamentation that we associate with the houses, it wasn't just about showing off. The Victorians had this belief that ornament was connected to moral goodness. And I know that sounds a little bit strange to modern ears, but stick with me. We're going to explore exactly how that idea developed and why it led to some of the most maximalist architecture in history. So we'll talk about that. We're also going to talk about why, just a few decades later, people were so exhausted by all that excess that they embraced the simpler arts and crafts aesthetic that we covered, you know, I think a couple months ago. All right. The whole thing is this big story about faith, fire's involved, the Industrial Revolution. It's a story about moral crusades. It's a story about how ideas shape the buildings that we live in. So it's a huge story, and to understand all of it, or at least the part we're going to cover, we got to start with that fire that I talked about. All right, so picture London on October 16 of 1834. There will not be a quiz on the dates, but October 16, 1834. The medieval palace of Westminster, which is home to Parliament and has been for centuries, that building is burning. All right, October 16, 1834, it's on fire. Massive flames light up the Thames as thousands gather on bridges to watch history, you know, burn. It's a national disaster, but it's also an opportunity. The decision about what's going to rise from those ashes ends up defining an entire era of architecture. Okay, so before we get to that, though, I do need to back up just a little bit, because to really understand Victorian architecture, we need to understand the Victorians themselves, you know, what they believed, the world they were living in, and so on. So let's look back at that just briefly, and then we'll get back to that fire. All right, so let's go to like 1830s, 1840s. At that point, Britain is being transformed by forces that really no other earlier generation could have imagined. And I think it's hard for us sometimes in the modern world to think about that. But think about your grandparents, you know, what they saw, you know, the changes that they saw over their lifetime is pretty dramatic when you think about all the things that they saw. We make jokes about how they can't handle technology, you know, how like my grandparents can't handle technology or my mom and dad struggle with technology. But think about it, you know, when they were little kids, I don't even know if paper existed at that point. And now, you know, just in 70 years, they've got iPhones or whatever, and we've expected them to figure out everything from pencils all the way up to laptops, and they've done a pretty good job. You know, I know we've got to get a hold of them and help them out at inconvenient hours when they've forgotten their passwords to everything, but think, you know, they mastered the pencil, and now they're trying to master the iPhone or the iPad or whatever. So our parents have seen a lot of changes. Our grandparents have seen crazy changes. Well, same thing was happening in the 1830s, 1840s for the Victorians. You know, they were seeing changes that no other generation really could have imagined. The Industrial Revolution, it's in full swing. Factories, they're roaring. Railways, they're connecting cities that once felt a world apart. You know, everything's connected now. Everything's within reach. New technologies are flooding the market with goods that used to be handmade. You know, for the first time, you can mass produce beauty. You know, carved wooden brackets, ornate iron railings, elaborate plaster moldings. Things that used to require skilled artisans can now be stamped out by machine. So decoration, you know, it used to be rare, it used to be costly, now it's affordable. That's really important, you know, to consider everything that's coming. At the same time, money's flowing in all kinds of new directions. You know, it's not just the aristocracy who can build great big grand houses anymore. A whole new middle class is rising. Factory owners, merchants, professionals, they're all coming into their own a little bit. And they want their homes to reflect that success. You know, their learning, their knowledge, their place in the world, in society. But this new industrial age also is a little bit scary to them. It feels cold. It feels mechanical. You know, the air's full of smoke. The cities are expanding faster than anybody can really process and manage. And a lot of people are uneasy. So the medieval world with its cathedrals, its handcrafted goods and all of that, and its sense of spiritual order, all of that starts to look comforting. You know, romanticism is sweeping through art and literature. People are reading Sir Walter Scott's novels about knights and castles. They're looking at Gothic ruins through a haze of nostalgia. You know, the good old days kind of a thing. That's the world that young Queen Victoria inherits in 1837 when she takes the throne at just 18 years old. And the architecture of her reign captures all of these contradictions. You know, modern machines building all these things that get layered and, you know, crafted into something that almost has a medieval look. You've got industrial wealth wrapped up in spiritual, you know, ornamentation, which I'm going to explain all of that in a little bit. You've got mass production, but it's kind of disguised as craftsmanship. All right. All of that's going on. All right. That's what the Victorian era is like. That's what these people are living with. Now let's get back to that fire. All right. The fire on October 16, 1834, when Parliament is burning to the ground. All right. When that building burned, a design competition was launched for the new building because we burned one down. We got to replace it. We need a new one. Let's find one. Let's have a competition. You know, it's kind of like what we do. We do a lot of little competitions and contests. I'll explain a new one that's running at the end of the show, but they were doing the same thing, probably giving away gift certificates to Repcolite or something like that. But they had a contest to see who was going to be designing this new building. And they had a couple requirements. It had to be done in the Gothic or Elizabethan style, and classic architecture, you know, Greek columns, Roman temples, that was banned. You know, it felt too pagan. It felt too French. Nobody wanted that. Nobody wanted it to feel too French, too pagan. Britain wanted something that looked distinctly English and morally upright. All right, so that's the contest that they're running. The winning design came from two men, Charles Barry, an experienced architect, and Augustus Welby Northmore Pugin. He was a young, passionate Gothic revivalist. And I want to take just a quick second here to say that for any history buffs out there, go subscribe to the Home in Progress podcast, or at least check it out. Next Tuesday, I'm going to drop a bonus episode that dives into the full story behind this fire, plus the crazy partnership between Charles Barry and Augustus Pugin. I can't get into all of it here, but it's a great story. It's funny. It's a little bit funny. It's tragic, and it's honestly kind of unbelievable in certain regards. Just to give you a quick teaser, the British Prime Minister, Lord Melbourne, at the time called the cause of the fire one of the greatest instances of stupidity on record. So we'll talk about that and why it was so stupid. And also we'll talk about why the working relationship between Barry and Pugin spiraled into a feud that lasted nearly a century. So a ton of drama in that story, and we'll cover it all in that bonus episode next Tuesday that will drop. If you're subscribed to the podcast, you'll get the notification automatically and you won't miss it. Otherwise, you can catch it anytime at repcolite.com. All right, back to the story at hand. As I mentioned, Charles Barry and Augustus Pugin worked together on this new project for the Palace of Westminster. Charles Barry handled the layout. Pugin poured his heart into the whole Gothic thing, you know, all the detailing, the spires, the arches, the tracery. But he was more than a decorator. He was an absolute crusader. And this is really important to the story. In 1836, a couple years later, he published a book called Contrasts. And on one page in that book, and you can go find the book online and kind of flip through the pages. It's interesting. But on one page, he'd draw a medieval church, you know, soaring, spiritual, full of purpose. And then on the facing page, he'd have a modern factory or, you know, some utilitarian workhouse. It was ugly. It was soulless. It was dehumanizing. And his point was really, really blunt. You know, the architecture of the Middle Ages was Christian and honest, and the architecture of modern industrial England was morally bankrupt. You know, that was his idea. He believed that architecture revealed the soul of a nation. So a Gothic building, he felt, shows its structure honestly. You know, you look at it and you can see the flying buttresses doing their job. Nothing's hidden. Nothing's fake. Classical buildings, on the other hand, sometimes used things like even decorative columns, you know, columns that didn't do anything. You know, they didn't hold anything up. They were just there for looks. It was a lie in stone, as he saw it. It's interesting. Pugin actually converted to Catholicism in 1834, the same year, you know, the Palace of Westminster burned. And what's fascinating in that, the reason I say that's interesting, is that his conversion was deeply architectural in nature. You know, it was theological too, but deeply, deeply architectural. He didn't just study medieval churches. He found his faith in the architecture that they were built with. You know, to Pugin, Gothic architecture wasn't just beautiful, it was true. Every pointed arch, every carved detail, all of it was a visible expression of faith. You know, it was like praying in stone in a way. I know it sounds a little weird, but that's what was going on. He saw so much beauty and so much truth in it, so much power in that architecture. And that conviction that he had, that conversion and all of that, shaped everything that he designed afterwards. So churches, altars, tiles, wallpaper, even furniture, and all of it came together really, really spectacularly in his work on the new Palace of Westminster. He worked himself to exhaustion over the course of his life, and he died in 1852. You know, he's just 40 years old. So workaholic, he really poured everything he had into this stuff. But even though he died young, his influence was massive. He transformed Gothic Revival from this quirky, old-fashioned kind of thing into a moral and national cause. And the Houses of Parliament, you know, the new building that he designed, completed way after his death in the 1860s, still stands as his monument. You know, a building that declared to the world that Gothic wasn't just beautiful, it was British, it was moral, it was official, it was upright, it was true. All of those things. And again, I've got way more info to that story. Subscribe to the podcast and you'll catch that on Wednesday. A lot of really interesting stuff in that. All right, so that's Pugin. And if he made Gothic moral, John Ruskin, another guy we need to talk about, made it emotional. You know, he made beauty itself a moral good. And we're going to get to that and how that shook out right after this. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Top-tier paint, expert advice. Your next project is way easier than you think it's going to be. All right, we've looked at Augustus Pugin and his role. Now let's look at John Ruskin. And while Pugin argued that Gothic design was moral in nature, you know, we talked about that, while he did that, John Ruskin took it further and advocated that beauty and ornamentation themselves were moral goods. Ruskin, he wasn't an architect. He was an art critic. He was a social philosopher. You know, he was kind of like a 19th century influencer. You know, rather than creating little TikTok videos or Instagram posts, he was writing. And the books he wrote, The Seven Lamps of Architecture, The Stones of Venice, some of these books were bestsellers. And they do sound kind of exciting, right? The Seven Lamps of Architecture, you know, Sinbad and the Seven Lamps of Architecture, or Indiana Jones and the Stones of Venice. Really, they could have been movies. But, you know, movies weren't all that big back then, not like they are today. And so he just wrote books. But they were bestsellers, and they went and inspired generations of builders, artists, and reformers. But the ideas in the books about ornament, they were radical, and they changed how people thought about decoration beyond just, you know, in that era. It really changed it, you know, moving forward. We're still living with some of the ideas that he was advocating in those books. Here's his main argument. He's floating the idea that ornament isn't a luxury. You know, decoration isn't just a luxury. It's not something that you tack on after the real building work is done. Ornament or decoration or whatever you want to call it is essential to human dignity and spiritual health. That's his argument. Now, why? Why in the world is this important or essential? He says it's because When we create ornament, it requires creativity, it requires skill, and it requires joy. So when a medieval craftsman would carve a column, you know, the very top of the column or something, or when he would carve a decorative stone way up high on a ceiling, when he did that, you know, so high that nobody's really even going to see it, but he's still putting all this design and intricacy into that work. When he's doing that, he's expressing, that craftsman is expressing his God-given creativity. So that part's really important. And also, he loved the little irregularities in the carvings. You know, the uneven leaves, the lopsided faces that show up from time to time. Those aren't flaws. To Ruskin, they're absolute proof of human freedom. They're absolutely beautiful. You know, a machine makes perfect copies, and that's boring. A person makes variations, and those variations are the mark of a soul at work. So big, heady, thinky people stuff here. You know, that's what's going on. Ruskin went so far as to claim that you could judge the moral health of an entire society by its architecture. So medieval Venice, with its richly carved Gothic palaces, was a place that celebrated creativity. Renaissance Venice, with its restrained classical symmetry, had already started to value order and precision over the spirit of the craftsman. You know, that's what Ruskin is saying here. Ruskin also believed that ornament taught people. You know, a building carved with flowers, animals, figures, stories, you know, all of that playing out on the walls of the building, those things could educate and they could uplift. It could bring beauty into everyday life, and it would make the ordinary sacred. You know, the same idea is true of great, big, amazing, beautiful churches. You know, sometimes the argument is that they shouldn't be there. You know, that money should be spent on something else, and yet the argument that could be made against it is that by having it in these instances and in these buildings, it's free and available for anybody to experience and to enjoy. And we all work through our daily lives, you know, the grind and the mundane of it, and we can stop by some of these massively beautiful places and experience just a touch of the sacred in our ordinary life. You know, that's the notion that he's expressing. A plain wall teaches nothing. An ornamented wall is kind of like a public gift. So to Ruskin, ornamentation and decoration weren't frivolous. They were morally essential. Beauty wasn't a luxury. You know, it was a necessity for human flourishing. You know, if we wanted to become the best we could be, we need this beauty in our buildings, in our architecture, in our homes. That's the idea. A plain, undecorated building, you know, that's not, to him, a sign of modesty or a sign of honest simplicity. It's a sign of spiritual poverty, in a sense, and it's a denial of human creativity. All right, that's the beginning of the story of, you know, Victorian architecture and all that it entails. And it's a quick look at some of the key characters and the ideas driving them. But how do we get from those ideas, you know, lofty ideas about moral, the moral power of beauty, how do we get from that to the multicolored painted lady Victorian houses that we picture in our minds? Well, we're going to get to that right after this. This is Home in Progress, where the to-do list is long, and that's all right. We're not crabbing at you. We're not going to yell at you. That's how it is. It's how ours is, too. It's proudly supported by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore, because home projects are easier when you've got people you can trust. All right, so how do we get from all of that philosophy stuff, that heady stuff, to the bold, extravagant, you know, opulent houses, the painted ladies that we think about today when we think about Victorian architecture? Well, to get to this part of the story, we need to remember a couple of things. And I hinted at them and talked briefly about them at the very beginning. But we're in an age at this point of mass production. So Ruskin, you know, we specifically talked about him last segment. He personally hated machine-made ornament. You know, that was something that he absolutely detested. It lacked the irregularity of the human hand. He hated the perfection with which these things could be stamped out. But his followers and the public missed that subtlety. You know, as they're processing and adapting and applying his ideas, they missed the nuance there. They latched onto the bigger idea that decoration equals beauty and beauty equals virtue, but they missed the whole concept that machine-made ornamentation is a negative. So they're really good with the idea of machine-made ornamentation for reasons we'll get to. And they're operating with the idea that, okay, decoration's beauty, beauty is virtuous. So if you can afford to decorate, you really should be. So now you can start to see where things start to get a little exaggerated, a little exuberant, let's say. And, you know, by the 1860s, 1870s, Ruskin's influence is showing up everywhere in what we call High Victorian Gothic. You know, you're getting bold, polychromatic brickwork, pointed arches in multiple colors, heavily carved details, unapologetic ornament. It's just gone nuts at this point. And there's one big reason all of this could happen. We've already talked about it. It's technology. You know, the Industrial Revolution made it possible for people to be able to order decorative pieces from a catalog. You know, if you wanted fancy brackets for your porch, all of a sudden now you can flip through some pages and there they are. They look good and they're in stock. You know, Amazon's going to drop them right off. If you want cast iron railings or, you know, pressed tin ceilings, whatever, just pick your pattern from the book and it's all going to be shipped to you by rail. So for the first time, ordinary people could afford ornament. You didn't need to be wealthy to have an ornate house. You just needed to be middle class. And that was a whole new thing going on. And if Pugin and Ruskin, the people that, you know, a lot of people were aware of their writings and their thoughts, if they were preaching that ornament was morally uplifting, then why wouldn't a respectable middle class homeowner want as much ornamentation as possible? I want to be as moral as possible. So I'm going to put on wallpaper on top of my wallpaper. Well, that idea eventually finds its most vivid expression in Queen Anne style. Now, I mentioned it earlier, but there's no one single Victorian style of architecture. We talked about that. Instead, the Victorian era saw numerous types of architecture arise, and all of them are considered Victorian. There's Gothic Revival. We covered that. There's the Italianate style that took off in the 1840s, 1850s. Second Empire style that arrived in the 1860s and 1870s. And Queen Anne, that style came about by the 1880s, 1890s. This is the style that most of us picture when we hear the word Victorian. Now, the funny thing about Queen Anne style is that it really doesn't have all that much to do, if anything, to do with the real Queen Anne from the early 1700s. You know, Victorians just borrowed the name. You know, they needed something that sounded respectable, that sounded historic. So they came up with Queen Anne, and it gave their new style a touch of old world class, right? What they actually were doing was creating this style that was this huge mix of everything they loved. It was absolutely as eclectic as possible. You know, a Queen Anne house, you can't draw it symmetrically, you know, on paper. You can't draw it symmetrically. It's all towers and turrets, you know, wraparound porches, bay windows and gables. You know, pretty much every single angle that you look at reveals something new. You've got a stained glass window over here, a big band of, you know, fish scale shingles over there. You've got turned spindles, you know, carved brackets, intricately carved brackets, bits of trim wherever you look, you know, it's just a lot going on. And that's just those elements, you know, those trim elements or whatever you want to call them. You've got the color on top of that. And we've referred to these houses already as Painted Ladies. But you know, that name's a name that stuck for a reason. They didn't paint their houses white. We all know that. You know, three colors on a house, that was completely conservative at that point. You know, a painted lady, a true painted lady might wear five, six, even seven colors all at once. And each one is going to be highlighting a different detail. You know, the gables, the porch posts, the gingerbread trim, the window frames. It was architectural drama made visible through paint. You know, they highlighted all of these different elements with different colors. You know, it was crazy in that regard. The textures, they were just as lively as the colors. You know, you might have smooth clapboard siding over here, you know, on the first floor. Then you might have patterned shingles, you know, maybe scalloped or fish scale or something like that on the upper story. And then a little half timbering up in the gables. Different materials doing different jobs, all loudly on display. Victorians weren't trying to hide construction. They were celebrating every single aspect of their home. Now, inside, the same thing happened. The same thing continued through. You've got high ceilings with elaborate plasterwork, pocket doors between parlors, built-in cabinets. Every single room had its own personality and its own purpose. And that purpose was largely expressed through decoration. The Hackley and Hume homes in Muskegon are absolute, you know, stellar examples of all of this. If you've never been through those homes and you don't know what I'm talking about, look into it. You know, you can arrange tours. I think they're open for tours from May through October. You'd have to check out their website. But Hackley and Hume Homes, you know, excellent examples of this Queen Anne style that I'm talking about. All right. At the end, let's recap and put all of this together and hopefully answer that big question that we started with. And that's, why did Victorians build this way? You know, why all the layers? Why the flourishes? Why the sense that no surface should be left untouched and undecorated? Well, five things to take away from this. First off, they did that because they believed that beauty mattered. You know, it wasn't luxury. It was essential. Augustus Pugin, we talked about him. He taught that honest ornament was morally right. Ruskin taught that it reflected human creativity and dignity. So if you could make something beautiful, they would argue that you should. A plain building wasn't noble. It was almost a failure of goodness itself. So they did it because beauty mattered. Second, they did it because they could. For the first time, you know, we talked about that. Industry was making beauty affordable. The moral urge to build beautifully lined up perfectly. You know, everything came together with the ability to be able to do it. Third, they built this way because in this new industrial society, your home mattered more than ever. As a statement of who you were. You know, it's always been true to some degree. But now, at this point, the middle class could finally afford to, you know, make a literal statement, you know, with their homes. They could talk about who they were through their homes. And in a fast-growing city full of newcomers, family names didn't mean as much anymore. But your house, that did. That could tell people exactly who you were and how you fit into society. You know, the style of the home, its ornament, its color. All of it communicated taste and education and refinement. So they built that way because it was important in that regard. A fourth reason they did it is because they were anxious. You know, we talked about it. Life was fast at that point. It was noisy. It was uncertain. And they did what we do. You know, we look back to what we call the good old days, you know, the quieter times, the time when there weren't 8 million people on the road trying to go exactly where I want to go. You know, we remember those days when, man, maybe the roads had a biker or two on them, you know, and that was a pedal biker, not even a motorcycle rider. It was just quiet and we could go wherever we wanted. They were living the same way back then. They were inundated with the whole Industrial Revolution and a lot of growth that happened very fast, a lot of noise, a lot of busyness. And they just started looking back to historical stuff and saying, man, those good old days sure do like that. And that's how Gothic and Italianate and Queen Anne, all of those styles kind of came to be. And they gave people a sense of comfort and continuity and a link to the past, you know, something solid to the good old days. Finally, fifth reason they built this way, and this one's a no-brainer, they did it because they thought it looked good. You know, they really did find beauty in this. You know, we might see clutter, but they saw craftsmanship and care. They saw beauty in all of that. So that's the story behind the growth of what we refer to as the Victorian era in architecture. But there's one more important part to the story that I want to cover, and that's its decline. You know, why did it all drop off? When did that happen? We're going to get to that right after this. You're listening to Home in Progress, where the projects are real, the mistakes, they're educational, sometimes painful, mostly educational, and the only thing more stubborn than that old wallpaper on your bathroom wall is your determination to get it fixed. Proudly sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Paint with a purpose, people who care, and everything you need to get the job done right. All right, let's wrap this conversation up by looking at the eventual decline of the Victorian style. Now, by the time Queen Victoria died in 1901, the style that bore her name was already fading. You know, interestingly, the same currents of thought that helped create it, you know, especially Ruskin's love of honest handcraft, you know, handcrafted goods, that idea, you know, the love of those handcrafted items was turning against the movement, the arts and crafts movement. We talked about it a few weeks ago, but it was led by figures like William Morris, and that movement began as a kind of moral correction for the Victorians. Morris agreed with Ruskin that medieval craftsmanship, you know, literally making things by hand, represented honesty and dignity, and it was the better way to go. He completely rejected the mass-produced ornamentation that was filling up these late Victorian homes. Now, we talked about it already, but Ruskin himself wasn't big on how people adopted these mass-produced items. He didn't like that either. He did like that handcrafted goodness. But Morris, you know, he took it to a new level. He was a loud voice, and he steered things in a completely new direction. You know, he advocated for simplicity, for restraint, for visible, honest construction, actual handcrafted work. And if you'd like more info on that, go back again to the podcast and check out episode 424, where I really dig into William Morris and why he was so important. It's a really good segment, and it'd be really nice to pair that one with this one. You know, so after catching this one, go check out that one, episode 424. It's like pairing the right meal with the right wine or something like that. That's how wonderful these two would be together. Anyway, William Morris kind of kicked against the Victorian opulence as he saw it, and he wasn't alone. You know, people were growing tired of the excess, you know, the layers upon layers, the seven-color paint schemes. They wanted something, you know, more authentic, less busy. They wanted colors that they could remember when they needed to repaint. I'm convinced of that. You know, I'm looking at this from a practical point of view. You know, think about it. You paint your bathroom, right? And then 3 years later, you know, unless you save the can or wrote the color down, none of us have any idea what that color actually was anymore, right? Can you imagine doing that with seven colors on the outside of your home? And then on the inside, you know, I did mention the Hackley and Hume houses in Muskegon in the last segment. The exteriors of those houses have 13 or 14 different colors on each one. And the insides, you know, the insides of the homes, I think in there there's over, I believe it's over 100 different colors. You know, all kinds of stencil work. It's nuts. It's amazing. You know, our Muskegon Repcolite has helped with a lot of the color matching through the years at those houses. So I know the numbers are insane for the amount of colors, the number of different colors in those homes. And one more thing about the Hackley and Hume homes. The Hackley house features more hand-carved ornamentation. The Hume home, because money was a little more of a consideration, that home is going to feature more machine-produced ornamentation. And I could be slightly off on that. It's been quite a while since I've been there, but I think I'm right. And more importantly, just go check those homes out. But my bigger point of bringing those up again is to say check them out, but also to talk about the number of colors. You know, can you imagine 100 and some colors in your interior? You would need a full-time person just to catalog and chronicle which colors were used where and which color was needed when a repaint was necessary. Well, people were sick of that. They didn't have money for all these extra people to catalog their colors. They didn't want to have to go through all of that, create databases in order to figure out what was in the bathroom, you know, color-wise. They wanted simplicity. They wanted to move away from all of that busyness. And so people like William Morris, their ideas started to catch on. And soon, new modernist thinkers were declaring things like ornament is crime. You know, ornament was beauty not even too long from this point, but now it's completely flipped on its head, and ornament is crime. And something, you know, another mantra that came out of this era, it's something that we still hear today, less is more. You know, that's where that idea comes from, a direct reaction to the Victorian era. But even so, with all of that said, it's really important to point out that the Victorians left us with something really amazing. You know, their architecture shaped our cities in tons of ways. You know, they filled all of our cities with imagination. You know, their row houses, their churches, their train stations, whatever, their public buildings, they're still among the most recognizable and beloved buildings in the world. You know, we love looking at Victorian homes as we drive around through neighborhoods. It's just, it's so intriguing. It's so amazing, you know, to see all of what's going on in those. But even though we maybe don't want that for ourselves, it's still wonderful to see that, and it really creates a lot of interest. They left a powerful idea behind, you know, that architecture isn't just engineering, it's communication. You know, it should be expressive. It should be varied. It should be meaningful. It should tell stories. It should evoke emotions, you know, and that's an idea that we still hold on to, and one that will never go away and shouldn't go away. You know, we talk about it at Repcolite with paint colors. You know, the paint colors you choose, that should tell a story. It shouldn't just be, well, that tan matches with whatever tan in your couch. You know, that's important. But having that vision for where you want to go with a room, the story you want that room to tell, it sounds crazy, but the paint color can help you get there. And that idea doesn't necessarily start with the Victorian movement, but it really, really came to the fore, you know, the forefront in the Victorian era. All right. Speaking about telling your story with color, I want to talk briefly about Benjamin Moore's new color of the year for 2026. And I don't have much time left, but I want to say that they revealed it last week. And if you don't know, it's Silhouette. It's a brown color with hints of charcoal in it. It's really earthy. It's pretty much what a lot of people were predicting, at least the type of color, you know, an earthy color. And the supporting color trends colors, they're all earthy as well, and they work really well with it. Now, over the next few weeks, from time to time, we're going to talk about these new colors, how to work with them, why it's worth bothering with, all of those things. But I bring it up right now mostly because way earlier in this episode, I mentioned a contest that we're running right now. And I told you that I'd get to it by the end. So here's the deal. Find Repcolite on Facebook and Instagram, and you'll find a post showing you some of these color trends for 2026. That post has all of the details for the contest, but here's the quick scoop. Go there and in the comments on one or both, Facebook and Instagram, in the comments on either one of those or both, write down which of the color trends colors moves you to paint a room in your house. You know, all you got to do is say, Rain Dance moves me to paint my living room. Something like that. Super easy. Tell us which color moves you to paint which room in your home. Every comment you enter counts as an entry into the contest. And then on November 16, I'll draw four random winners, and each one is going to receive a $250 gift certificate to Repcolite. So four huge prizes, all for leaving a comment on a social media post. All right, that's all the time we've got today. If you want to catch this episode again, you can find it online at repcolite.com. And don't forget, ScuffX from Benjamin Moore is still on sale at all Repcolite locations through October 31. It's over $24 off per gallon. It's a huge savings for an amazing product. That sale is going to end after October 31, so don't miss out. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Home in Progress. Thanks for tuning in. If you liked what you heard and you want to hear more like this, definitely consider subscribing to the podcast if you haven't done that already. And also, if you feel so inclined, leave us a review. A kindly review will help other people find the show, and that really helps us out. Thanks again for listening. I'm Dan Hansen for Home in Progress. I'll see you next time.